the whole idea around everything that that I do, everything that I try to figure help advisors do is to say, hey, we have, there's this whole other element to the relationship that I call the human side. Again, not a very like, you know, novel term. It's pretty simple, but it gets the point across. But it's one of those deals where nobody really teaches you how to do it. Nobody really said you get trained and you get designations and certifications for all the technical knowledge you need. And that, and you need to have that. That's great. We all need that. But there's not very much out there on how to actually sit there and work with and talk to and create a human connection with another human being on an emotionally charged topic like money. And so the whole focus, the whole purpose was to set out and say, I think there's other people that are interested in this, that know that this is important. And ultimately what it came down to was like, there's a lot of really, really good ideas out there about how to create human connection, about around behavior, psychology, communication, anything in those fields. There's a lot of really good research and insights, but what the problem was is there's this major gap that exists where it's like, yeah, there's really good research and studies on the mind, on money, on behavior, psychology, communication, but there's not a great link that says, hey, here's what you need to know. And then here's how you go and use it day in and day out with clients and with prospects to not only enhance their outcomes and their experience with you, but also to change the trajectory of your business, to boost your business as a result as well. So that's kind of been my primary mission for the last 4 years now, is to go out and say, okay, from an advisor perspective, I'm not going to become an expert in psychology. I'm not going to become an expert in money memories. I'm not going to become an expert in necessarily behavioral finance, but I do want to know day in and day out, what are some of the most important things I can do to create a more human experience and embed more human connection in the work that I do with clients? So the whole purpose, the whole thought is, how do we make this as practical and applicable and tangible as possible? So not leaving you some study about how important it is to build trust, but how do you actually build it? Not saying, hey, there's this bias that's out there that's probably preventing your client from doing the things that they need to do, but saying, hey, your client may be struggling to follow through on what you're asking them to do. Here are some practical, tangible ways to actually get them to follow through and change their behavior to do what you know that they need to do. That's what the whole idea is, to say, let's move past the research and say, in practice, how do I bring these things to life? So real quick, before we get going on that, here's one thing I lay out before anything that I ever do virtually: trainings, presentations, one-on-one conversations, is four things. One, bring on as many questions as you have. No such thing as a bad question. Don't raise your, we're in Zoom. You can raise your hand if you want, but I guess we'll use Slido. So throw your questions in there. Close as many windows as possible on your computer. Close all of them if you can, to try to minimize distractions. Put our phones on do not disturb, right? Minimize distractions. My phone's in a drawer on do not disturb over there at the moment. And more than anything, let's commit to excellence. Let's commit to do the things that we know we need to do. I'm going to ask you guys to do a few things over the course of the time together that aren't there simply to try to fill time and fill space, but they're things that have been proven to work that'll make a difference in your practice and in the relationships that you have with clients. And I guess the way I always like to sum it up is this, is we've got an hour and a half, well, a little bit less than an hour and a half now. And so what my promise to you is that if you guys can give me your undivided attention and your commitment to doing these things and putting forth the effort, then we'll make it fun, we'll make it informative, and I can assure you that you'll walk away with at least one thing, if not more, but at least one thing today that will not only enhance the way and improve the way that you work with and interact with clients, but it'll also change and help you grow your business. And so that's my promise to you, if you guys can give me some your undivided attention. Now, I do feel pretty confident that this group's probably more dialed in than the average presentation that I go and give to a group of advisors. But that being said, I know that we're busy. It's easy to sit there and like look at your email, check your email from time to time. But the more engaged we are, the better the outcome, the better the results are going to be. At the same time, I know that we're a bunch of adults and grown-ups. And so if you don't want to do that, you don't have to do it either. I can't force you to do anything, but that's what I'm going to encourage you to do. So, all right, we'll get rolling. Here's the game plan for today. Basically, we're just going to do four things. We're going to hit on four things. Number one, we're going to talk about the importance of the human factor with some numbers and stats to back it up, because I know it's something that we all tend to understand intuitively. Like if you went and said, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Advisor, hey, so-and-so, do you think it's important to know how to work with human beings and to be able to build trust and connection? Is that an important part of what you do? In fact, I've asked advisors and nobody ever says no. that what the majority of them say is it's important and I do a few things, but I don't really know the most important things to do. So, but first thing we're going to do is talk about exactly why it's important, so we can talk about why we're going to spend some time on it today. And then from there, we'll move into the essential skills that you need to start honing or focusing on or being aware of to develop, to create human connection and the interactions that you have with clients and with prospects. Then we're going to play a game to help you practice those skills, to also give you a feel for where you may need work, give you an idea of what it's like to do it well. And then the last thing we're going to do is talk more very specifically about how to take what we've learned, take the things we talked about, and then walk away and apply it and embed it in your planning process. Again, back to the idea of making it as tangible and as practical as possible. The idea is not to say, hey, let's talk high level and theoretically and esoterically about a bunch of cool concepts, but it's to say, how do you walk away from this conversation today and be better with your clients and make your practice better off tomorrow? That's the whole goal. That's the focus. And I'm going to set the stage or the background. It's already on here a little bit, but I want to point this out. And that is, when you're thinking about how do I embed the human component, the human aspect, create a more humanized experience for my clients and my practice, it really boils down to two primary things. You've got number one on this side, the skill set. So there's things you can do, skills you can focus on, develop, be aware of, like asking great questions, listening with empathy and curiosity, being curious, being present. There's skills that you can use, that you can develop. And then after you develop the skills, then you go and you say, okay, how do I take these skills and use it with my clients? That's where we're going to talk about the process. So we start with the skills, and then we take and say, once you have these skills, how do we think about applying them inside of our process? So that's what the framework that we're going to go through. That's what this game plan is lined out to do. Any questions yet, Allison?
Nope, I don't see any yet.
Okay, well, I was hoping there'd be one so I get my coffee break here, but we'll keep going. All right. So this chart, a lot of numbers, small print, a lot of graphics, a lot going on. Just know this. We talk about the importance of trust quite a bit. Like, nobody denies that trust is important. In fact, trust is sort of the foundation of success in financial advice. You're not going to be a very successful advisor, or you're not going to be very successful with your clients if you can't create and establish and, in fact, probably accelerate the trust and connection you're able to create with them. But this study was done to sort of validate that, to show us what the benefits actually are. And if you look on the right-hand side, the far right-hand side, that column, Those are people that responded and said, I have a high level of trust with my advisor. The circles on the left-hand side are those that said, I have a low level of trust. And the ones in the middle say, we have a medium level of trust. So as you can see, if you start going down this chart, here's what we see. The high levels of trust on the right side correlate to higher satisfaction with their advisor. It correlates to a higher likelihood of recommending their advisor. The second one down, the third one down, is it correlates to whether they have actually recommended their advisor to someone and given a referral. The fourth circle down says, if you have a high level of trust with your clients, they're more likely to consolidate or give you more assets to manage. And then the last one is on the flip side. So you can see the green circle there says, hey, these are the clients that have a low level of trust, will have a higher likelihood of switching to somebody else and moving to a different advisor. Now, these are those kind of stats that I call no-brainers. Now, we had no-brainer decisions, and now we have no-brainer stats where you sit there and you go, yeah, so none of that surprises me, but it's still good to see it illustrated and backed up by research and by data, right? So ultimately what we're saying is it's important to have trust, but why is it important to have trust? Because a high level of trust with your clients, with your prospects, leads to higher satisfaction, more referrals, more assets, and higher client retention. Four things that I think anybody would say, those seem like four pretty good qualities to have in a client. In fact, if you could map out your ideal client, you'd probably say, yeah, they'd be satisfied, they'd refer me clients, they'd consolidate assets, and I would keep them for a really, really long time. The key to that, one of the core components of that, is being able to build, accelerate, and establish trust. So here's the next one. There's a study that was done. They went out and they polled clients. They said, hey, what's the most important characteristic when you're looking for a financial advisor? And the number one thing, the bars in green are what advisors guessed. So they asked advisors too. That's mildly important. We're really more interested to know what clients said. The clients' responses are in blue, and you can see the number one response by far, 69% of clients said that the most important characteristic that they're looking for is trustworthiness. Again, not one of those things that's mind-blowing or shocking in any way, but just good data to validate what we think we already know. Here's another one about what clients say they look for in a financial advisor. What qualities are important when you're looking for an advisor? 82% of clients said the number one most important thing are the interpersonal skills, communication skills, building rapport, caring about me, understanding my needs, listening, and empathy. Not the number of designations that you have, not the quality of your advice, not the service and white glove experience that you provide. Now, all those things matter. Don't get me wrong. All those things are vitally important. But if we're saying, hey, what's the number one most important thing that you're looking for from your advisor, or when you're looking for an advisor, it boils down to trust, interpersonal skills, and basically showing that you know and that you care. We're going to look at, and this is some research that's been done. I don't have a graphic for this one. There was research that was done out of the University of Georgia that says the number one predictor of your client's financial success is the relationship that you have with the client. So to me, it's cool to put that on there. I say it every now and then and I hear it, but then I really think about it. It's like, wait a minute, hang on. The number one predictor of my client's success is the relationship that I'm able to build and establish with them. Not my knowledge, not my credentials, not my white glove service. It's the relationship that I'm able to establish. And so now, quick caveat, just by the way, this is technically the number two predictor of success. So there should be an asterisk after it saying the number two predictor. The number one predictor was receiving a financial windfall. Or receiving a lot of money. So we'll caveat it and say that the number one predictor of client success that's completely within your control is the relationship that you have with the client. And now I always think that, so stats are good, research is good, but I also think that anecdotally, it's good to hear from advisors who have said, hey, I've made an effort with this, and this is the way that it's impacted me and benefited the work that I do. So the top left is a message that came from a guy who decided to start focusing on the human side. He said, you know, for what it's worth, I've won more clients in the last month by focusing on the psychology and the why behind their goals than in my entire first year in the business. The second one on the right, on the right-hand side. So this is a text that the guy got from a prospect that ultimately picked him over two advisors that had 25 years of experience in the industry, and he'd only been in it for 3 years. So he was at a disadvantage, technically speaking, from a knowledge standpoint. And the guy texted him and said, hey, thank you for sorting all the financial bits for me. I really appreciate it. Also, thank you for listening. It's really nice to be able to talk and feel no judgment. It was just what I needed. Now, that guy's never been through, and none of his technical knowledge taught him how to listen and make the person feel heard and understood, but he made it a point to focus on that in the meetings that he was having with his prospective clients. And it wasn't the fact that it wasn't his knowledge and his credentials that ultimately got him the client, so that he can help him moving forward. It was the fact that he was the one that listened the best and made him feel heard, made him feel understood. And then the last one is an email I got from a guy that's been through some of the training. We worked on it, getting better at the human side. And he said, as you can see, if you haven't already read it, I'm having my best first year and attribute it much of my success to focusing on the human side and having a great first meeting. Ironically, he just emailed me again this weekend and said, hey, Brendan, I just landed the largest client I've ever landed. They're about to have $10 million in assets. And it was all because I focused on the human side. Now, is that true? Probably not, but it was certainly a big component of it because he put the work in and realized how important it is. All right, before we go to this, I'll pause and see if we have any questions.
The hashtag is good vibes in slido.com if you want to drop any questions in there. I don't see any yet, Brendan.
Okay. All right. So the question, so we know that trust is important. I just skipped ahead a little bit. So sorry about that. Try not to read too much ahead, but we know that trust is important. We see the business altering, the client altering, the relationship altering benefits of trust. But ultimately, this was always my big issue, always my rub. The thing I couldn't stand was that's great. But how do you actually go about creating or accelerating or instilling this trust, both with prospects you're meeting for the first time, but also with clients? In order to do that, you have to understand a few important things about how the brain works with trust. And so we're not going to go into a big psychology lesson. We're not even going to go down the path of Danny Kahneman and break down the different roles of the brain. But the best way to think of it is you have two parts of the brain that are operating at all times. Daniel Kahneman in Thinking Fast and Slow, he'll call them System 1 and System 2, also known as the System 1 is the primitive brain. System 2 is the executive brain. Here's all you need to know. The primitive brain is the part of the brain that you've probably heard the term fight, flight, or freeze. That's where that's the part of your brain that you're operating out of when you're in fight, flight, or freeze. That's the amygdala, the primitive brain. And when you're in that state, you're not in a place to trust anybody. You're sitting there thinking, how do I survive? And you're not making logical, sound decisions. It's not the place that you want somebody to be operating. It's great if you're trying to survive. One of the examples is always, it's great if you're out on the Sahara and you hear a lion rustling in the bushes, because it tells you, hey, you got to go. We need to move. But it's not great for connecting and decision-making. The second part of the part of the brain that you want people to be operating out of when you're meeting with them and talking with them, is the executive brain, because that's where you build trust. You solve problems, you focus on goals, you can socialize, because you're not captivated, you're not gripped by fear or anxiety or stress or whatever it might be. So the goal is to always get somebody into the calm, problem-solving executive part of the brain. So here's ultimately, how do we take that and use it, or what do we need to know about it? Well, every time you come into an interaction, a conversation, especially with a prospect, but also with clients, they're coming in and their brain is literally searching or trying to answer the question, am I going to be able to connect with this person, or do I need to protect myself from this person? So in other words, it's going, is it okay to sit in the executive brain system too, or do I need to go and protect myself? So the way that I heard it described on the podcast from one of the guests was, she said, your brain's always trying to decide between red light or green light. Do I need to protect, or can I connect? And if you think about it, if we want to think more real or tangibly, more experientially about what this is like, anytime you're in a conversation with somebody and you're sitting there thinking like, man, this is a good conversation, it's going well, I'm enjoying this, like the time's flying by, your brain's definitely not in protect mode at that point. It's in connect mode. You know, everything's going well, everything's clicking, you're going, this is a good conversation. Those conversations where you're sitting there, you've got somebody in the room with you and it feels like you can't get them to open up, you can't get them to tell you anything, that's because they're still in protect mode and you haven't gotten them to where they feel safe and comfortable to be able to connect and tell you things. And so that ultimately one of the things becomes, what we want to know is how do I get them into connect mode? How do I get them to feel safe and comfortable to open up with me? And it's determined by what you say, how you say it, and what you do. And we're not going to go into all that today, because we could do a whole thing on this just in and of itself. But one of the most powerful ways to get somebody out of protect mode and into connect mode, or one of the most powerful ways to send them there from the very beginning, is to get them to talk about themselves and to show genuine interest in them. So we know from research that if you look at the research, it shows that getting somebody to talk about themselves, when they put their brain on these neurotransmitters, these devices, when they talk about themselves, the same areas of the brain light up as when you eat chocolate and engage in sexual activity. Now, I didn't put a picture of sexual activity on here because I didn't think that would go over very well. Also, if you're not sure how many people like chocolate and sexual activity, if you don't, just know that the vast majority of people like both of those things. But it's important to realize, we go, hang on, wait a minute. So if I get somebody to talk about themselves, now I'm getting them in the part of the brain that, not the two brain parts that we just looked at, by the way, it's different, but it's the part of the brain that goes, wow, I really enjoy this. It's the reward system. So when they're talking about themselves, that reward system part of the brain is lighting up. And that's why when you've had a conversation with somebody that you know, or you're sitting there talking to somebody, maybe for the first time, second time, and you're going, man, this conversation is going really well. I really like that person. I want to spend more time with them. I think we should hang out with them more often. The odds are, if we went back and had a video of that conversation, I'm going to say with about a 99% success rate that you talked more than they did, or maybe more importantly, they asked you more questions about yourself than you asked of them. And you walk away thinking, man, that was a great conversation. But of course you did, because you got to talk about yourself the whole time. And it was like you were eating chocolate the entire conversation, and you're going to enjoy that every time. So that's one way, is to get people to talk about themselves. Quick stat, Moira Summers, author of Advice That Sticks, says that 80% of 80% of satisfaction in the first meeting has to do with the amount of airtime the clients get. The primary determinant of satisfaction in the first meeting has to do with the amount of airtime that, the prospect or the client gets. So we know if they, we can get them to talk about themselves and show an interest in themselves, then that sends them, that lights up that part of the brain and it sends them into connect mode where they feel like they can open up and talk and tell you important things that, you need to know. One of the best way actually to get somebody to do that is to get really, really good at asking questions and understanding the power of asking questions. So there was a study done by the Harvard Business Review several years ago. What they did was they had two groups of people. You can see it on the screen. So on one hand, they had a group that sat down, two people across the table from each other, having a conversation. And they said, you can ask no more than four questions of the other person. So 15-minute conversation, two people, no more than four questions that you can ask the other person. They took another group, and they said, all right, two people sitting at a table, you have 15 minutes. You have to ask at least 9 questions in that 15 minutes. So they go, they have thousands and thousands of conversations. They pull the people afterwards. They sit them down. They get some, they talk to them. They go back and watch the videos, watch the conversations to analyze what happens. And basically what they found after analyzing all these conversations is that the group that asked 9 or more questions, they found that that group, the responses said that they were more likely to trust and like the person. So let me phrase it this way. Here's what you learn when they look at the responses. Asking questions is proven to create and instill trust and likability. The people said that I feel more connected and I trust that person. It uncovered and yielded more valuable information because the people said they were more willing to share information. They also saw that they divulged more information. And it provided them with clarity that they didn't have about a certain topic before. And that's why I always say, we'll always say that asking great questions is a superpower, because if you can just ask great questions, you can create trust, create likability right out of the gate, and uncover valuable, sensitive information, all key components of being in financial planning and financial advice. You have to get somebody to like you, to trust you, and to tell you important information, because the reality is The quality of your financial plan, the output of the financial plan, is directly related to the information that goes into it. So the great plan, you can't have a great plan with good information. You have to have great information to have a great plan. And your ability to get great information depends on your ability to get the information from the person. So it builds trust, builds likability, and gathers sensitive and personal information, which you need somebody to tell you, especially if you don't know them very well. You're trying to get them to tell you things that they don't even tell their best friend after a couple bottles of wine. So how do we do that? Because here, let me start. I forgot about this quote. So here's a quote that I really like that sort of sums up this whole trust building concept. It's from Bill Bachrach. You guys may be familiar with him, but he says it better than anybody could. So there's no reason to try to reinvent the wheel. But you don't build trust by telling your story. You build trust by listening to theirs. Now, here's part of my thing still. It's like that, even then we go, okay, Brendan, that's interesting and that's good. But, and I know, okay, so asking questions is good. And yeah, just simply asking more questions is effective, but it's not just about asking more questions. There are ways to ask questions, techniques when it comes to asking questions that actually get even better answers and create even more connection. So I teach a bunch of them, but I tried to peel out probably the top 5 that we're going to walk through. We're going to skip that for now because it's important, but not as important as this. So I pulled out the top 5 that I think are important to internalize when you think about how do I get better at asking questions to create connection, to create trust. We're going to walk through each one of them a little bit individually. All right. Number 1, a great question without great listening is no longer a great question. I have a quote that I'm going to use to explain this in a second, but just if you think about it, think about the last time you were talking to somebody. They asked you something, you're excited they asked you. You're like, yeah, I can't wait to tell you about this trip that we went on, how my business is doing, what I did with my kids. And then they ask the question and you're telling them the answer. And the next thing you know, they're distracted and they're doing something else. And you're like, can I finish that? Okay, never mind. And it just kind of feels like a bummer. You're like, do they really care? Or were they asking because they felt like they needed to ask? Robin Dreeke is an FBI hostage negotiator. So that, you know, they're focused on these communication skills all the time. Here's how he sums it up. He says, am I genuinely interested in the other person? Am I able to put my ego aside and suspend all judgment? Am I prepared to truly listen as opposed to just acting as if I'm listening? Because if you don't and can't do all of these things, it can undermine the rapport you're trying to build with your question. So the key thing I'm going to highlight there, we could, again, this is something else we could spend an entire session on, but the key I'm going to highlight there is he's not saying that, hey, if you ask a great question and you don't listen to the answer, it basically invalidates the question, or, you know, it just, you could say it's a neutral situation now. No, he's saying if you don't listen after you ask a question, it actually undermines the rapport. It sends you backwards instead of propelling you forward. So a great question without great listening, no longer a great question, and it can actually cause some harm. Number two, so the order of your questions creates conversational flow. I'm gonna try to explain this and sum it up really quickly there, but there's a study done a number of years ago where these two psychologists said, hey, I wonder if we can create better conversations and more connection by escalating the level of questions that we ask. So you can see there it says set one, set two, set three. Set one was somewhat personal. Set two was more personal. Set three was the most personal. And so they said, hey, if we do this and we just escalate the emotional intensity, does that create better conversation? What they found ultimately, just to try to like to save time and not go into the details, is that it created better conversation, more connection. It got people to open up and talk, tell you things. And there was even one couple that after a 45-minute conversation fell in love and ended up getting married. And that's kind of what put this study on the map, because it was kind of crazy. But the key is the way that you ask questions, the order in which you ask questions is important. You have to earn the right to ask better, deeper, more emotional questions. Some of the questions that you kind of want to ask because you care and you know, it's like, hey, I want to ask this question, but I hope it gets received well. I don't know if we're there yet. I don't know if we're on that level. Sometimes you are, sometimes you're not, but you can ask them as long as you build up to them, because you have to earn the right or pave the way to ask those questions. And so what I want to do for this is not give you a list of questions across all three, like to say, hey, ask this, 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 and this. But the most important piece of this is asking the questions out of the gate that send people into connect mode, like we just talked about. But not only does it send them into protect mode, what happens when you get somebody in protect mode is it creates this conversational flow where it gets them, oh, it opens them up, they get going, they get talking, they get excited, and they're ready to keep telling you things. So I haven't figured out a better way to say this. This is gonna sound harsh. If somebody has a revision for this, please let me know. But if you do this part right, your problem doesn't become getting somebody to open up and tell you things. Your problem becomes, how do I get them to shut up? Because we only have an hour and I don't know that we're going to be able to pack it all in, because now they're telling me about what their sister's best friend did last weekend. And you're like, hang on, I'm glad that you trust me with this. I'm glad you want to talk to me, but we don't have all day. So the problem isn't, how do I get them to open up? If you do this right, your problem becomes, how do I better control the conversation, which is where you want to be. So how do you do that? Well, you ask what I call the three E questions. Questions that are easy to answer, exciting to answer, and have an emotional component tied into them. Here are a couple examples. I'm in Nashville. So you could just simply ask somebody, you know, how did you end up in Nashville? What brought you to Nashville? How did you get to Nashville? Because it's easy to answer because I've answered it before. It's kind of exciting because I get to sit there and talk about myself and reflect on my past. And there's always an emotional component to it, because there's something that, not super emotional, but there's always something that happened that brought you here or kept you here, whatever it might be. Another one, if you work with business owners, is saying, just getting them to talk about their business, or people to talk about their kids. But with business owners, ask them, hey, you know, I know we've been working together for a while, or we've never worked together, and I'm kind of curious, you have this great business, you're doing well, but how did this idea even come about? Where were you when this idea was born to create this business? Did you ever imagine it would get to where it is today? And it's going to be like 10 minutes later, they're still going to be telling you about the origin story of their business. And you're going, okay, all right, well, now we got to move on. We got to transition to do something a little bit different, but I'm glad that you were excited. Tell me that another one that somebody shared with me the other day that you've probably heard before, but it fits into this category all the same, is when you have a couple, asking the couple how long they've been together and how they met, how they got together. Anything that gets a couple talking about themselves. These questions are all easy because you've answered them before. they're exciting because you get to talk about yourself and reflect on things that you're passionate about, or the, and they have an emotional component tied in to all of them. So those are the questions to ask. The questions you want to try to avoid, the ones that don't create conversational flow, are the ones that I call lazy questions, which are, how are you? How was the weekend? How was your day? What do you do? Every time I go get my haircut, the guy at the haircut place says, how's the family? How's life? And I'm like, you know what? I don't sit around thinking about how is my family and how is life. So it becomes a really difficult question to answer right out of the gate. So focus on the questions that create conversational flow. Secret number three, the most powerful question you can ask is a follow-up question. And I believe this to my core. I always believed it, but the more you do it, the more you practice it, the more you start seeing it. The most powerful question you can ask is a follow-up question. There's a quote that I heard one time was that somebody who said that the key to truly actually understanding people lies in your ability to ask follow-up questions, because you're going to get a surface level answer a lot of the times at first, and it's up to you to go deeper and figure out what's really behind it. Here's why they're so powerful though. Because when somebody asks you a question and you're answering it and you're talking to them and you're telling them, you're answering the question, you're excited to talk about yourself. We already know how this works, right? Your brain's in the reward center. You're getting to talk about yourself, answer a question. And so anytime somebody asks you a follow-up question to what you just said, it instantly signals to you that they're interested and that they care. And it gives you permission to keep going and expand on what you were saying. It signals interest. It signals curiosity. It makes you feel safe and go into connect mode, because you go, oh, they really do care about what I have to say. So now I can go a little bit further, because the brain's always going, okay, how much do I really want to share? How much do they really want to know? And you're trying to hold back and to see, do they really care? Question, follow-up question, which says, hey, I listened to you and I want to know more. And you go, okay, whew, all right, now I can open up and go a little bit further. That's why the key to understanding people lies in the follow-up question. Now, here's one thing I'm going to say that we're going to run through it quickly, but it's important to know. There are really good follow-up questions, and then there's not so good follow-up questions. Any follow-up question is good, let me say that. But there are ways that where they lose their effectiveness. And that's when you start telling us, you ask a question so that you can relay your own experience. So you ask a question where it shifts the conversation off of them and back to you. Here's a perfect example. Client says, hey, my family just got back from a trip to Italy. When we go, oh, really? Did you go to Rome? Yeah, we did. Oh, man, we love Rome. My family and I went there 2 years ago. It's great. We love it. Did you go to this restaurant? Did you go here? Did you do this? And that's in and of itself. By the way, when you read that, if you're really, really good at communication or you know this already, you're not going to have a gut-wrenching feeling. 99% of us read that and we go, oh, shoot, I do that all the time. Right? Like, you're like, oh, man, I probably did that yesterday, where somebody said something and I asked, I followed up because I wanted to relay my own experience. It's not bad. So let me stress that. It's better than talking. Yeah, you're at least asking them a question, but it does subtly shift the focus from them to you. So you do have to be careful about asking follow-up questions the best way. So here's an example that I like to run people through in a real life situation or conversation with a client. So you have a client that calls, this is focused on follow-up questions, right? So you have a client that calls and they say, hey, Allison, I'm calling because I haven't been feeling great lately. I'm nervous about my ability to retire with this crazy inflation, and I'm not even sure if I'm investing correctly anymore. And so there's a number of ways you could respond to this, but I'm going to put two of them up here just as an option to say, all right, what do we think would be the best way, the best response, the best follow-up question for that? And in a smaller group, I would ask what people think. Very few people get this wrong, I should say. But the best way to follow up is to say, yeah, number two, inflation is certainly crazy. Can you tell me more about what you mean by investing correctly? Number one's not a bad response. You're at least asking a question. Are you thinking we should change your asset allocation? Maybe you get there at some point. But if you look back at what they said, I'm not even sure if I'm invested correctly anymore. That's the core of what they're calling about. That's their concern. But we don't really know. You have no idea what that means. What do they mean when they say, I'm not sure if I'm invested correctly anymore? Are they literally thinking, you know, I'm not sure if I need to have 60% of my portfolio in equities with part of that internationally because I'm not sure how that handles the standard deviation of the portfolio? Probably not. But that's kind of what we're thinking. Instead, what they're probably thinking is, I'm not sure if I'm invested correctly anymore. Oh, what do you mean by that? Well, I guess what I'm really concerned about is like the way that I'm invested, the way the market's going, am I still going to be able to retire in 3 years? They didn't say that, right? They said, I'm not sure if I'm invested correctly anymore, but that's probably what they meant. So that's why the key is to ask follow-up questions to uncover what somebody truly actually means. And that's when they start to feel heard and understood. All right, two more. Number four, structure your questions to improve conversational flow. We already talked about creating conversational flow. There's also ways to ask questions that make somebody more likely to open up and answer it better. Believe it or not, you can take two questions, ask two different ways. You can take the same question, ask it two different ways, and get a completely different response. What we know from some research is that when you ask a question, that if you ask a question that ends in a question mark, that it actually increases levels of stress and can get someone to shut down. That's why you may have heard somebody say not to ask questions that start with why. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why is this important to you? Because when you ask that, it feels accusatory, it has a question mark on the end. It actually raises stress levels a little bit. It sends us to the wrong part of the brain. Makes us feel like we're back in school where we're supposed to have a correct answer. So instead of asking questions, the idea is you want to shift the focus to, I'm not asking somebody a question. I'm not grilling them with a question. What I'm trying to do is invite them to share more information with me. And there are ways to start your questions. There's ways to begin the question that actually result in that vibe where you're saying, hey, I'm asking you this, but it creates a collaborative feel where you're inviting them to tell you more. So how do we do that? Right. That's good. That's the question we always want to answer with these is how do we actually do that? Okay. So how do you ask questions that create conversational flow? You can start by saying, you know, I wonder if blank, or I'm curious, what does it mean that I'm curious what you mean when you say not invested correctly anymore. So instead of just saying, what makes you say you're not invested correctly? Or why do you feel like you're not invested correctly? You know, I'm curious what you mean by I'm not invested correctly anymore. And it creates a more collaborative feel where you're saying, hey, I want to explore this together. You can take a question that you want to ask and put, I'd like to know in front of it. So I'd like to know more about what you mean by invested correctly, or tell me more. So tell me more about what you mean by invested correctly. That's one you've probably heard before, right? Tell me more. I've always felt like that feels a little bit awkward at times. So these are other things you can say in addition to that, hopefully. You can repeat somebody's exact words back. So if they say invested correctly anymore, you can go, this one takes a little practice, by the way, but it's really effective. You just say invested correctly and pause. And there's this natural response within us to fill the blank and answer or to elaborate on what was meant. Or just simply when somebody says something and they're telling you what's important to them, just asking, okay, what else? What else is important to you? What else would you like to do? So the way you ask questions actually impacts the answers that you're going to get. This takes a little bit of practice, but if you start practicing and working on it and you start inserting some of these things, number one, you'll get comfortable with it. Number two, you'll see the difference that it makes and you'll go, I need to do more of that. So that's something to kind of practice a little bit first. Last one. Oh, wait, no, hang on. Sorry. I've got same example that we looked at. And I just used this one, but the second response is using one of the phrases to encourage a response. So that's completely understandable. I'm curious what you mean when you say invested correctly. I forgot I put the example in here. All right, last one, maybe the shortest one, maybe the easiest one, and also one of the most effective, and that is pre-framing your questions for context. So anytime you have a question that you want to ask, need to ask, feel like you should ask, you sit there and go, I want to ask this question, but I don't want it to come off the wrong way. I want to ask this question, but, and you're hesitating. This is where you bring in the pre-frame. And anytime you pre-frame your question and explain why you're asking it, it paves the way to a better response. People go, okay, as long as you have a reason why you're asking me this question, then I'm more willing to answer it. So whatever the question is, tell them why you're asking it, and it'll change the response that you give. So the example is at the bottom is the one that I use. So if you want to ask somebody, hey, why is money important to you in your life? What's important about money, but it feels a little bit awkward, or you want to ask them what was money like growing up, or whatever the question might be, all you have to do is tell them why. So the example down below is this: for if you want to ask somebody why is money important to you, and it feels a little bit weird, you're wondering why do they want to know if I'm asking that? Just tell them why. Say, hey, okay, so I have a question I want to ask you. It's one of my favorite questions to ask because we believe that money is simply a tool to fund the life that you want to live. And in order to help you do that, to align your money with what's most important to you, I want to take some time to talk about what's most important in your lives. So let me ask you this. What's important about money to you? And then let them talk. Because it doesn't, if you tell them why you're doing it, there's another study out there. I'm not going to go through it right now for the sake of time. There's a study that was done that basically says, as long as you give people a reason, they'll almost always comply with what you ask them to do. So tell somebody why you're asking the question, and you don't have to worry about, should I ask it? What are they going to think? Are they going to feel offended? So pre-framing your questions opens the door for better answers, because you don't have to worry. They're not going to go, why are they asking me this question? They're going to know exactly why you're asking it. All right, we'll pause there. I've got this question game we're going to do next to kind of, so, well, maybe wrap it up by saying this. That was a little overview, high level overview of some of the skills that go into building trust and creating connection. We're going to work on the skills quickly for a little bit, and then we're going to move into the process piece. So before we do that, I'll pause and see if there's any questions on that.
We do have one question from Kevin Brennan. It says, I've been working on and struggling with this for the past couple of years and do not feel as if I am not as I should be. Some people just don't respond, leaving me feeling very insecure about my effectiveness. Perhaps I am being too hard on myself. Is my insecurity and ineffectiveness common? Feel free to unmute if you want to elaborate.
Yeah, trying to get that all into a
little bit.
And it's just, I guess another way is, you know, I hear the stories that people just have this great success with it. And maybe I'm comparing to myself to them, which isn't always healthy. And I also realize there's a lot of people who embellish their effectiveness too, which can add to that. But, you know, I definitely see the value with this and do have, you know, some success with it. I guess I know it can be better. I haven't been able to figure out how to get that. But also, is there some people that this just does not work with? And, you know, I guess leading to, I've got to just stop worrying about that. And I'm probably not going to be able to help those people to the extent, because it just doesn't resonate with them, or they're not willing to open up. Does that make sense the way I asked that?
Yeah, I think so. Let me ask you this. I'm curious what you mean when you say this.
What did I say this? I guess trying to use this process there again, and coming from a different, you know, old school Dean Witter, you know, brought up through that environment where none of this existed. And so I've never really had any training on this other than trying to read and hearing, you know, going to conferences and all, et cetera, which is why I'm here. But the process of really trying to get into the mindset and elicit those emotions from prospects, That's what I mean by this.
Yeah. And meaning like, into the mindset of listening to those emotions, like you're sitting there and you're connecting with them. You can tell that you're connected. You're having a good conversation. You've probably experienced it before, is what I'm guessing. You're trying to tell me what the feeling was like when you've had it before, like where you're in a meeting, they're opening up, they're talking, they're telling you things. You feel like you're asking questions and they're just like the conversation's firing on all cylinders. And you go, the stars aligned last night. Or did I wake up and have a couple cups of coffee this morning? Did they wake up on the right side of the bed? And you're trying to figure out like, why did this go so well? And how do I do that more often? Is that?
Yeah. And how do I, you know, there's a certain element that the term I use over the years of people who come in and it just feels like they're looking for a mini storage for their money. You know,
like they're what? Say that again. Like they're what?
A mini storage for their money. They have a rollover, they've inherited some money or built up some money in the bank and kind of know they should be probably doing something different, but they want to come in and here, take this and do what's best with it. But they don't want to really take the work to get down into, you know, the weeds, so to speak, of, you know, what is important, what ultimately do they want this money to do for them. And I don't know if that's a little bit of laziness or a little bit of intimidation or what it is, but it just becomes this, and we just want to rush. We don't have time to do this. Just take it and invest it the way it should be invested for someone like me. Well, okay, what is someone like you? Does that give you
I think I'm getting it now. So basically, in other words, it's like if somebody comes in and they say, hey, just take it, invest it, you're like, hey, wait a minute, I want to know, like, what is it that you want to do? What's important to you? What do you want to accomplish? I don't even necessarily need, like, we can be good friends, we can be best friends, but I don't even necessarily need that. I just want to have a better conversation, a deeper conversation with you on what we can use this money for, how we can, like, what are we aiming for, planning for, how do we use it to fund this life? Because ultimately, like, what's the point of making money if it's not being used for things that are important to you? And so you're finding that, so sometimes you'll have people that they're not necessarily opening up and going there, and right, it's just, hey, here's my money, and you can't get them to tell you those other things about their life.
That's exactly right.
You know? Okay. All right. See, that's, by the way, quick point. That's the importance of follow-up questions, right? Because had I just sat there and taken your first question that you asked, I didn't know that's what you were actually asking. I would have answered something completely different, right?
Yeah.
So that's why, like, sitting here just kind of hashing through it, following up, getting a little clarity. Now we're a little bit more dialed in. In fact, if we had more time and you and I were sitting here one-on-one, I'd probably ask you a few more questions, but for the sake of time, I can't. I'll try to answer it a little bit more. I'll answer that, but also a little bit more generically. So number one, you're not alone. Number two, I hear it all the time. It's one of the main things that drive people to some of the work that I do, is people are saying, like, they're like, hey, I want to have better, deeper conversations, but sometimes I just can't get people to open up and go there. How do I get them to tell me some of these things when they say, hey, all I want to do is talk about the money side? So happens all the time. Definitely not alone. What I would also say for you though, Kevin, is like the fact that you're aware of it and asking that question tells me that you're a step ahead of most. Most people probably just assume, like, oh, well, that's probably somebody that just doesn't want to talk about it. Or, you know, I did everything well and they're just not engaging, but you're at least you're stopping, reflecting and going, hey, is there something that I could be doing better? Which I think you deserve props for, because one of my biggest frustrations are the people that say, well, I guess the client just didn't want to talk to me about this. And it's like, well, no, most people, 99%, would like to talk about themselves and their life and what's important to them, right? Like, find me somebody that says, hey, yeah, I'd rather not talk about what's important to me in my life. But give me an hour and I'll tell you everything you want to know about things that are important in my life. 99% of people want to do that. The problem is that they don't see or perceive a financial planner, a financial advisor as being somebody that would want to talk about that or that does talk about that. So think about it like this. Imagine you go to your doctor and you sit there, you're there for your annual checkup and your doctor's like, hey, tell me what you want to accomplish in your life. And you're like, what? What do you mean? I thought we were just drawing some blood, maybe doing a little, you know, testing some things out. Maybe you're going to do a few swabs here and there. I figured you'd ask me some things about my health, my lifestyle, but what do you mean what's important to me in my life? So it just throws you off a little bit, right? And so there's a lot of different things we can say, a lot of different routes we could go with this. The thing I try to stress the most though is mindset-wise, remember that if you do it right, there's a 99% chance in the person that you're with wants to talk about those things. They just don't know that they can, or they're not ready or prepared for that conversation. And there are ways to prepare them for that, right? Like, you know, in that example I just gave with pre-framing the question, right? Saying, hey, we believe that money is a tool to fund the life you want to live. And in order to fund that or make any decisions, we need to know what's important to you. Otherwise, we risk making a decision that's out of alignment with the things that are important to you in your life. You can, like, if you frame a meeting that way and say, hey, we have a plan in place to help you with these investments. These investments first. We need to have a quick conversation about what's important about money to you, and tell them why you're doing it. Then they go, okay, all right, I could see why that's important. Now, they may not open up instantly, right? But at least let them know why you're doing it. And nobody ever says, hey, you know what? I appreciate that, but I don't really want my money to fund my life. I just want as much money as I can possibly get. And that's all I need. Now they may say that, but that's not what they actually want. But so there's a whole nother conversation to be had around that. But that's just, the one thing I would say is setting it up appropriately is really, really important. Setting expectations beforehand so that they know coming in that that's going to be a topic of conversation. And we're actually going to talk about that in a minute. The last thing I'll say is this, is if we're talking specifically about new prospective clients. So somebody, like you said, in your example, somebody comes in, they're like, hey, I had this rollover, I adhered to this money. I need you to do something with it. I need you to show me what to do or put something together and invest it. What you have to remember also is anytime you're meeting with somebody for the first or second time off, and I know actually you guys have probably already talked about this because I know Stephanie knows this too, but something prompted that conversation. They had something happen, something go on. They didn't wake up and say, I can't wait to meet with Kevin today. That's how I want to spend my time, is meeting with a financial advisor. Like, that sounds fun. So oftentimes if we try to get somebody to this place to tell us about, they're saying, hey, I have this rollover that I really need help with. And they come in and you go, hey, tell me what money was like for you growing up. It's like, there's this disconnect where they're going, hang on. I just need my problem fixed. And you're asking me this question that I don't even know the answer to. So oftentimes at the very beginning, you have to start by answering their question and resolving with the stress in their mind before they're even able to get to a conversation where they can think about, okay, yeah, let's talk about what I want my life to look like in 10 years and who I'm going to be spending time with and the trips that we're going to be taking, if that makes sense. So A, you got to meet them where they're at, solve the problem, earn the right to get there. And then B, number two, you have to pave the way, set the expectation, let them know why you're having that conversation. And number three, you're very normal. It's a very common question. Everything we've talked about at this point is around the skill component, which quite frankly, that's the hardest part and the most important part. But what I always stress is once you develop the skills and know how to do it, know how to build trust, ask questions, build connection, then you have the skill set and then you take that into the meeting process, working with clients, the planning process. But you have to start by focusing on and developing the skill set that you can then bring to life in the meetings and the conversations that you're having with clients or with prospective clients. And so there's a lot of ways to do that. So what I wanted to try to do is map out for you guys one of the simplest ways I know of to embed the human component into the planning process in a way where you can do it pretty quickly and pretty easily. And maybe most importantly, you can do it in a way that's consistent and repeatable, right? So I said, when I was talking to Kevin earlier, I mentioned how, I hear this a lot too, where people will say like, hey, I had this really good meeting and it went really well. And I just wish I could do that more often. Or they'll be like, I had this person opened up to me. They said, we had this great conversation and I just wish I could repeat that again and again. I wish I could do that every single time. And what I always say is like, you may not be able to do that every single time, but there are ways to make this a more consistent experience, to make it more repeatable and predictable how you're having these type of interactions and conversations. So I had a worksheet put together. Allison, you want me to pull it up?
I can drop it in the chat.
Okay. Drop it in and then I'm going to pull up an example of it.
Okay, you mean the prospect process one?
Yeah. All right, so everybody's gonna get, and Allison, can you drop in the question menu as well?
Yep.
Okay, all right, so everybody's gonna get this PDF document. And the idea is to go step-by-step through your planning step-by-step through the planning process each meeting, to like have a structured, systematic way to embed the human component, at least step one of the human component. And we talked today about asking questions and asking great questions to get people to open up and talk. So you want to start addressing or creating kind of like a question framework for each one of these meetings. And if you have an idea and a framework of the questions that you want to ask, it naturally creates better conversation. So I put kind of an example up here for everybody to see. So what you want to do is you start at the top. Okay, so each one at the top, you want to label what meeting you're having. So the meetings are up top. So and the reason why I leave them blank is because everybody does it a little bit differently, right? So you've got your intro meeting, discovery, presentation, implementation, review. You may have less. Some people have more, but go through and fill out your flow. By the way, if you can't sit there and fill out your flow in about 20 seconds, then that's also another, you have another thing you need to do, which is map out your meeting process. And that if that's you, you're not abnormal at all. But a lot of people that's the first thing a lot of people do is they map out here the steps of my meeting process. I know that in this group, that's probably been talked about or addressed before, but I'll just say that first and foremost. And then the next thing you want to do is you go through each one. And you start by saying, okay, in my intro meeting, my fit meeting, whatever it is, what's the purpose of this meeting? Why are we here? What's the purpose? What are we doing? So the example that I gave is, all right, I have this intro meeting. The why we're here, the purpose is we want to be able to determine the fit, if they're a good fit for what we do and we're a good fit for what they need. And are they actually ready to move forward and make change and do something? And then the second thing you want to do for the purpose is think through and say, hey, what type of feeling are we trying to create from this meeting, from the prospect or from the client? Or another way to ask it to get an answer is to say, what kind of things do we want them to say when they get in the car and leave and with somebody after the meeting? What are the words that, what do we ideally want them to be telling each other? Or what do we want them to be calling their friends and talking about? So my example here was the feeling is you want them to be clear and confident that you can solve their problems. Like they're walking away going, hey, I feel better now about my situation than I felt in a long time, because I have hope that it's going to play out the way that I want it to. And I know that Allison and crew are going to help me make that happen. And the beauty of the reason why it flows this way, why you come up with the purpose, is because once you know the purpose of the meeting, why you're there, then that naturally filters into being able to determine the question framework that you want to use for the meeting. So here's the way I explain this when I'm working with people. Well, actually, so Allison just gave you guys a best questions menu. So it's a list of questions that I've asked advisors around the world. I say, hey, what's your favorite first question to ask in a meeting? And I got all these responses, compiled it into this document. So there's a list to kind of use to get your juices flowing. But here's what I would say is you could take a list of questions and you can take questions and not every question, they can all be good questions. Not every question is a great question for every meeting. Not every question is a great question for every step and stage of the relationship. And so if you're looking at this, if you have a list of questions that you're trying to pull from to plug into the meeting that you're going to have, you have to know what's the purpose of this meeting. If the purpose of the meeting is to determine their fit and whether they're ready to move forward, if the purpose of the meeting is to help them see that we can solve their problem, then asking what was money like for you growing up probably isn't a good question. It is a good question, but does it fit into the purpose of the meeting? If no, you probably don't need it. So I know Stephanie always says, and I love it too, because that's how I know she says it. But when your values are clear, your decisions are easy. When your purpose of the meeting is clear, when you have clarity on that, it becomes really easy to figure out what questions to plug in and ask at each step of the process. So you can see that for like this example down here in the question framework, there's three questions in there for an intro meeting. What prompted you to come in today? What prompted you? What caused you to come in? Why now? Like you could have done this last week. You could have done it 2 years ago. You could have done it 3 years from now. Why now? And then the last one is, let's fast forward 1 year from now. It's June 5th, 2024. What would you want this situation to look like? And so obviously, by the way, you have to finesse these questions a little bit. You wouldn't just sit there and go, hey, why now? Which you already know this, by the way, because we talked about how to ask questions and the skills around asking questions. But the purpose of this is try to go in. You want to try to have at least three questions in your framework for every single meeting. Because what happens is, as long as you have this framework to guide the conversation, then everything you ask after that becomes a follow-up question where you're getting the person to open up and talk to you and tell you the things that you need to know. It's not a script, right? You're not sitting there going, okay, I need to ask these questions, and you're checking off saying, all right, perfect. You're not conducting an interrogation. You have a framework to guide the conversation that fits into the purpose of the meeting, so that you know that you're asking questions that get you to exactly where you want to go, to exactly what you're hoping to get out of the meeting. And then from there, there's three other things that drastically enhance the human connection that are very tactical in nature. Number one is sending a pre-meeting email. This goes to the conversation, the question that Kevin asked, where he was saying, hey, what if somebody's not going there? What if they're not opening up? What if I can't get them? Well, one of the most powerful things that you can do from a meeting standpoint is you provide a roadmap for what you're going to be talking about by sending an email before the meeting saying, hey, here's what we have in mind. Here's some things we want to talk about. Here's what we're going to be doing. Here are the questions that we might ask. Oh, and by the way, is there anything you want to make sure that we cover that's not on here? So the brain desperately needs a roadmap, and we don't know what to expect. It creates stress. It raises anxiety levels. And that's the last thing you want the person walking into the meeting with, is a stress and anxiety, because that sends them to the protect part of their brain. So how do you get them better primed to go to a connect mode, better primed to have a better conversation? You have to let them know what to expect in the meeting, sending a pre-meeting email, and then in that email, referencing and having an agenda that you also bring to the meeting itself. And that tells them that basically that you have a plan, and we know what we're going to be doing moving forward. Now, you don't have to call it an agenda. You don't have to stick to it step by step, but just simply having it is going to lower anxiety levels and increase some trust. And then the last part is the post-meeting email. Now, here's the key here. By the way, this is something where I'm checking the time. Okay. So this is something where I had so many people mention, and on the podcast, so many advisors mention the power of their post-meeting email, this email that they would send after their meetings, that eventually I was like sitting there going, okay, hang on. Why do people keep mentioning this? There's got to be something to it. And then it keeps coming up. There's another advisor who said, when she looked at her net promoter score from like her feedback from clients, she had this great score, and the number one thing that her clients loved was the emails that she would send after the meeting. And here's why. Because for a long time, I sat there and I was like, that doesn't seem that crazy. That seems pretty standard. Why is it so powerful? Well, the biggest thing that these people would do that made it so powerful was they wouldn't just send an email. As we went back and looked at it, they didn't just send an email saying, hey, thanks for coming in. Here's what we need to do. Here's what we need you to do. And we'll follow up at this date. What they did was they would reflect back. Hey, here's what we heard you say. Here's what we said, heard you say you wanted to do. They would put it in their exact words, right? So they're saying, hey, you said not that you want to retire. You said that it's really important for you at some point in the future to have your feet in the sand and a drink in your hand, working only when you wanted to. Not retirement, but literally what did they describe as retirement? And when people get this email and they hear their own words repeated back, they go, wow, Allison really got me. By the way, Allison, I hope you don't mind me continuing to use you as an example, but they go, wow, Allison gets me. She understands me. She listens to me. And that builds and instills trust and connection. We all want to be heard and understood. And so when you write that out back to them in an email, that's exactly how they feel. And, or if you miss the point or you miss the mark, they'll correct you and say, well, I shouldn't say if you missed the mark. Sometimes people read their own words back and they go, you know what? That's not exactly what I meant, right? So you'll get some clarification on what they meant if you do that. So you want to make sure that you have for every meeting an email that you send out before with an agenda, and then follow up after the meeting, wrapping up with some of the typical stuff, but also making sure you're stressing what you heard them say in their own words so they feel heard and understood. So here's what I would encourage you to do is go through and do this for each step of the process. Go, okay, what's the purpose of this meeting? What questions can we ask in our framework that will guide this conversation to get us to what we're looking to do? What questions, what's the purpose? What are the questions that we can ask? And then you go down here and go, do we have a pre-meeting email for this? Do we have an agenda for this meeting? Do we have a post-meeting email template for this meeting? And walk through each one. Step by step. And once you've got all this filled out, you're going to find that your conversation flows more naturally. People are saying things like, thank you so much. I get you. All right. I feel heard. I feel understood. I feel like you get me. So on and so forth. And it takes a little bit of time, not too much. It might take 15 minutes to kind of walk through this and fill it out. But as long as you can map that out and plug the questions in here, I can assure you, I can promise you that the question that you're going to have better conversations moving forward. Any questions on that, or how to do it, or the ins and outs of it?
I don't see any in Slido.
Cool. Well, I know I didn't explain it that well, so maybe there must be another reason, but any other questions about anything?
We have a few minutes, so if anyone just wants to unmute and ask a question, that works as well.
I guess I don't necessarily have a follow-up question, but this session has been great. It's what I'm really starting to dig into. right now. I've been, you know, since I joined the program, dealing with the backlog of stuff. So it's been hard to get to as much of this as I wanted. I'm finally starting to come into the clear. So great timing. Like I said, this is a lot of what I've been thinking about. One of the biggest things that has been holding me back from getting to that next level that I want to get to. So appreciate it, and am looking forward to the challenges of trying to get it all dialed in.
Yeah. One of those things that takes a little bit of work, but it's worth it for sure. And as you're going through it, this goes for Kevin, goes for anybody and everybody that's listening. If you're going through it, you hit a snag, you're struggling, you're kind of like, wait a minute, what does he mean purpose? What do I questions? I don't know. How do I come up with three questions for an implementation meeting? Or a presentation meeting? Aren't I supposed to just be presenting the plan? Like, what's the point of a question? Then, let me know. I mean, you feel free to email me. I have my email on the slides. You guys can feel free to reach out. I'll be glad to help however I can, because this is something that I believe in, know that it helps. I'm passionate about. So I'm oddly passionate about. So I'm happy to talk about it pretty much anytime.
Yeah. And just, I guess a little follow-up part of, I tend to make things, I think, too difficult and too complicated.
Yeah.
Part of that is the, you know, the industry and the people we hear from in the industry. And I was at a, you know, conference a number of years back, and the sort of that discovery meeting was a list of, geez, probably 70 questions. And it's like, how do you get through that? That just seems so overwhelming. Yeah, but you know, hearing about the great success with it, and that's, I guess, the weakness in my mind. It feels like, well, if I can't do this, there's something wrong with me, or what I'm seeing here is just, it's very, what am I trying to say? it's taking a load off that, you know, there's a much simpler way of doing it, and that is okay. So yeah,
well, and not only that, but what I would say is 70 questions are, that's not good. You may think it's good, but I guarantee they don't ask all 70 questions at every meeting. I guarantee that it turns into more of an interrogation, because you're trying to get through so many questions, right? It's just, it's not natural. There's nothing natural about it. It's just, no, it's good to have questions. Obviously, you know that, but the simpler, the better. And when you get intentional about what you're going to ask and when you're going to ask it, it gets really, things get a lot easier from there. And what you'll also find happen is you start simple, you come up with three questions, and then you'll go, all right, well, I probably need to ask a little bit more. What else do I need to ask? But as long as you start somewhere, it's easier to make changes once you have something than it is to start from like just a blank page, right?